minus 90 and counting. The group Richards had come in with was now reduced to four. The new waiting room was much smaller, and the whole group had been reduced roughly by the same figure of 60%. The last of the Ys and Zs straggled in at 4:30. At four, an orderly had circulated with a tray of tasteless sandwiches. Richards got two of them and sat munching, listening to a pal named Redmond as he regaled Richards and a few others with a seemingly inexhaustible fund of dirty stories. When the whole group was together, they were shut into an elevator and lifted to the fifth floor. Their quarters were made up of a large common room, a communal lavatory, and the inevitable sleep factory with its rows of cots. They were informed that a cafeteria down the hall would serve a hot meal at 7 o'clock. Richard sat still for a few minutes, then got up and walked over to the cop stationed by the door they'd come in through.
"Is there a telephone, pal?"
He didn't expect they would be allowed to phone out, but the cop merely jerked his thumb toward the hall. Richard pushed the door open a crack and peered out. Sure enough, there it was. Payphone. He looked at the cop again.
"Listen, if you loan me 50 cents for the phone, I'll..."
"Screw off, Jack!"
Richards held his temper. "I want to call my wife. Our kid is sick.
Put yourself in my place, for Christ's sake."
The cop laughed, a short, chopping, ugly sound.
"You types are all the same. A story for every day of the year. Technicolor and 3D on Christmas and Mother's Day." "You bastard,"
Richard said, and something in his eyes, the stance of his shoulders, suddenly made the cop shift his gaze to the wall.
"Aren't you married yourself? Didn't you ever find yourself strapped and have to borrow, even if it tasted like shit in your mouth?"
The cop suddenly jammed a hand into his jumper pocket and came up with a fistful of plastic coins. He thrust two new quarters at Richards, stuffed the rest of the money back in his pocket, and grabbed a handful of Richards' tunic.
"If you send anybody else over here because Charlie Grady is a soft touch, I'll beat your son of a bitch and brains out, maggot."
"Thank you," Richard said steadily, "for the loan." Charlie Grady laughed and let him go. Richards went out into the hall, picked up the phone, and dropped his money into the horn. It banged hollowly, and for a moment, nothing happened.
Oh, Jesus, all for nothing.
But then the dial tone came. He punched the number of the fifth floor hall phone slowly, hoping the Jenner bitch down the hall wouldn't answer. She'd just as soon yell wrong number when she recognized his voice, and he would lose his money. It rang 6 times, and then an unfamiliar voice said,
"Hello? I want to talk to Sheila Richards in 5C. I think she went out,"
the voice said. It grew insinuating.
"As she walks up and down the block, you know. They got a sick kid. The man there is shiftless."
"Just knock on the door," he said, cotton-mouthed. "Hold on."
The phone on the other end crashed against the wall as the unfamiliar voice let it dangle. Far away, dim, as if in a dream, he heard the unfamiliar voice knocking and yelling,
"Phone! Phone for you, Mrs. Richards!"
Half a minute later, the unfamiliar voice was back on the line.
"She ain't there. I can hear the kid yelling, but she ain't there. Like I say, she keeps an eye out when the fleet's in."
The voice giggled. Richards wished he could teleport himself through the phone line and pop out on the other end like an evil genie from a black bottle and choke the unfamiliar voice until his eyeballs popped out and rolled on the floor.
"Take a message," he said. "Write it on the wall if you have to."
"Ain't got no pencil. I'm hanging up. Goodbye."
"Wait!"
Richards yelled, panic in his voice.
Just a second."
Grudgingly, the voice said, "She's coming up the stairs now." Richards collapsed sweatily against the wall. A moment later, Sheila's voice was in his ear, quizzical, wary, a little frightened. "Hello?
Sheila."
He closed his eyes, letting the wall support him.
"Ben? Ben, is that you? Are you all right?"
"Yeah. Fine. Kathy, is she..."
"The same. The fever isn't so bad, but she sounds so croupy. Ben, I think there's water in her lungs. What if she has pneumonia?"
"It'll be all right. It'll be all right.
I..."
She paused. A long pause.
I hate to leave her, but I had to. Ben, I turned two tricks this morning. I'm sorry, but I got her some medicine at the drug. Some good medicine.
Her voice had taken on a zealous, evangelical lilt.
That stuff is shit, he said. Listen, no more, Sheila. Please. I think I'm in here. Really. They can't cut many more guys because there's too many shows. There's got to be enough cannon fodder to go around. And they give advances, I think. Mrs. Upshaw?
She looked awful in black.
Sheila broke in, tonelessly. Never mind that. You stay with Kathy, Sheila. No more tricks.
All right. I won't go out again. But he didn't believe her voice.
Fingers crossed, Sheila. I love you, Ben. And I love...
3 minutes are up,
the operator broke in. If you wish to continue, please deposit one new quarter or three old quarters.
Wait a second!
Richard yelled.
Get off the goddamn line, bitch! You...
The empty hum of a broken connection. He threw the receiver. It flew the length of its silver cord, then rebounded, striking the wall and then penduluming slowly back and forth, like some strange snake that had bitten once and then died. Somebody has to pay, Richards thought numbly as he walked back. Somebody has to. -89 and counting. They were quartered on the fifth floor until 10 o'clock the following day, and Richards was nearly out of his mind with anger, worry, and frustration when a young and slightly faggoty-looking pal in a skin-tight games uniform asked them to please step into the elevator. They were perhaps 300 in all. Over 60 of their number had been removed soundlessly and painlessly the night before.
One of them had been the kid with the inexhaustible fund of dirty jokes.
They were taken to a small auditorium on the sixth floor, in groups of 50. The auditorium was very luxurious, done in great quantities of red plush. There was an ashtray built into the real wood arm of every seat, and Richards hauled out his crumpled pack of blams. He tapped his ashes on the floor. There was a small stage at the front, and in the center of that, a lectern. A pitcher of water stood on it. At about 10:15, the faggoty-looking fellow walked to the lectern and said,
I'd like you to meet Arthur M. Burns, assistant director of games.
Huzzah,
somebody behind Richard said in a sour voice. A portly man with a tonsure, surrounded by gray hair, strode to the lectern, pausing and cocking his head as he arrived, as if to appreciate a round of applause which only he could hear. Then he smiled at them, a broad, twinkling smile that seemed to transform him into a pudgy, aging Cupid in a business suit.
Congratulations, he said. You've made it.
There was a huge collective sigh, followed by some laughter and backslapping. More cigarettes were lit up.
Huzzah,
the sour voice repeated.
Shortly, your program assignments and seventh floor room numbers will be passed out. The executive producers of your particular programs will explain further exactly what is expected of you. But before that happens, I just want to repeat my congratulations and tell you that I find you to be a courageous, resourceful group, refusing to live on the public dole when you have means at your disposal to acquit yourselves as men, and may I add personally, as true heroes of our time.
Bullshit,
the sour voice remarked.
Furthermore, I speak for the entire network when I wish you good luck and Godspeed.
Arthur M. Burns chuckled porkily and rubbed his hands together.
Well, I know you're anxious to get those assignments, so I'll spare you any more of my jabber.
A side door popped open, and a dozen games ushers wearing red tunics came into the auditorium. They began to call out names. White envelopes were passed out, and soon they littered the floor like confetti. Plastic assignment cards were read, exchanged with new acquaintances. There were muffled groans, cheers, catcalls. Arthur M. Burns presided over it all from his podium, smiling benevolently.
That Christly, how hot can you take it? Jesus, I hate the heat.
The show is a goddamn two bitter. Comes on right after the Flicktoons, for God's sake.
Treadmill to Bucks? Gosh, I didn't know my heart was...
I was hoping I'd get it, but I didn't really think... Hey, Jake! You ever seen this Swim the Crocodiles? I thought...
Nothing like I expected. I don't think you can.
Miserable goddamn.
This run for your guns. Benjamin Richards! Ben Richards? Here.
He was handed a plain white envelope and tore it open. His fingers were shaking slightly, and it took him two tries to get the small plastic card out. He frowned down at it, not understanding. No program assignment was punched on it. The card read simply, Elevator 6. He put the card in his breast pocket with his ID and left the auditorium. The first five elevators at the end of the hall were doing a brisk business as they ferried the following week's contestants up to the 7th floor. There were four others standing by the closed doors of Elevator 6, and Richards recognized one of them as the owner of the sour voice.
"What's this?" Richards asked. "Are we getting the gate?"
The man with the sour voice was about 25, not bad-looking. One arm was withered, probably by polio, which had come back strong in 2005. It had done especially well in co-op.
"No such luck," he said, and laughed emptily. "I think we're getting the big money assignments. The ones where they do more than just land you in the hospital with a stroke, or put out an eye, or cut off an arm or two. The ones where they kill you. Prime time, baby."
They were joined by a sixth pal, a good-looking kid who was blinking at everything in a surprised way.
"Hello, sucker," the man with the sour voice said.
At 11 o'clock, after all the others had been taken away, the doors of Elevator 6 popped open. There was a cop riding in the Judas hole again.
"See," the man with the sour voice said, "we're dangerous characters. Public enemies. They're gonna rub us out."
He made a tough gangster face and sprayed the bulletproof compartment with an imaginary Sten gun. The cop stared at him, woodenly. Minus 88 and counting. The waiting room on the 8th floor was very small, very plush, very intimate, very private. Richards had it all to himself. At the end of the elevator ride, three of them had been promptly whisked away down a plushly carpeted corridor by three cops. Richards, the man with the sour voice, and the kid who blinked a lot had been taken here. A receptionist who vaguely reminded Richards of one of the old TV sex stars, Liz Kelly, Grace Taylor, he had watched as a kid, smiled at the three of them when they came in. She was sitting at a desk in an alcove, surrounded by so many potted plants that she might have been in an Ecuadorian foxhole.
"Mr. Jansky," she said with a blinding smile, "go right in."
The kid who blinked a lot went into the inner sanctum. Richards and the man with the sour voice, whose name was Jimmy Laughlin, made wary conversation. Richards discovered that Laughlin lived only three blocks away from him, on Dock Street. He had held a part-time job until the year before as an engine wiper for General Atomics, and had then been fired for taking part in a sit-down strike protesting leaky radiation shields.
"Well, I'm alive, anyway," he said. "According to those maggots, that's all that counts. I'm sterile, of course." "That don't matter. That's one of the little risks you run for the princely sum of $7 a day."
When G.A. had shown him the door, the withered arm had made it even tougher to get a job. His wife had come down with bad asthma 2 years before, was now bedridden.
"Finally, I decided to go for the big brass ring," Laughlin said with a bitter smile. "Maybe I'll get a chance to push a few creeps out a high window before McCone's boys get me."
"Do you think it really is?"
"The running man? Bet your sweet ass. Give me one of those cruddy cigarettes, pal."
Richards gave him one. The door opened, and the kid who blinked a lot came out on the arm of a beautiful dolly, wearing two handkerchiefs and a prayer. The kid gave them a small, nervous smile as they went by.
"Mr. Laughlin, would you go in, please?"
So Richards was alone, unless you counted the receptionist, who had disappeared into her foxhole again. He got up and went over to the free cigarette machine in the corner. Laughlin must be right, he reflected. The cigarette machine dispensed dokes. They must have hit the big leagues.
He got a package of blams, sat down, and lit one up. About 20 minutes later, Laughlin came out with an ash blonde on his arm.
"A friend of mine from the carpool," he said to Richards,
and pointed at the blonde. She dimpled dutifully. Laughlin looked pained.
"At least the bastard talks straight," he said to Richards. "See ya."
He went out. The receptionist poked her head out of her foxhole. "Mr. Richards, would you step in, please?" He went in. -87 and counting. The inner office looked big enough to play kill ball in. It was dominated by a huge one-wall picture window that looked west over the homes of the middle class, the dockside warehouses and oil tanks, and Harding Lake itself. Both sky and water were pearl gray. It was still raining. A large tanker far out was chugging from right to left. The man behind the desk was of middle height and very black. So black, in fact, that for a moment, Richards was struck with unreality. He might have stepped out of a minstrel show.
"Mr. Richards?"
He rose and extended his hand over the desk. When Richards did not shake it, he did not seem particularly flustered. He merely took his hand back to himself and sat down. A sling chair was next to the desk. Richards sat down and butted his smoke in an ashtray with the game's emblem embossed on it.
"I'm Dan Killian, Mr. Richards. And by now you've probably guessed why you've been brought here. Our records and your test scores both say you're a bright boy."
Richards folded his hands and waited.
"You've been slated as a contestant on The Running Man, Mr. Richards. It's our biggest show. It's the most lucrative and dangerous for the men involved. I've got your final consent form here on my desk. I've no doubt that you'll sign it, but first I want to tell you why you've been selected, and I want you to understand fully what you're getting into."
Richards said nothing. Killian pulled a dossier onto the virgin surface of his desk blotter. Richard saw that it had his name typed on the front. Killian flipped it open.
"Benjamin Stewart Richards, age 28, born August 8, 1997, city of Harding. Attended South City Manual Trades from September of 2011 until December of 2013. Suspended twice for failure to respect authority. I believe you kicked the assistant principal in the upper thigh once while his back was turned."
"Crap," Richard said.
"I kicked him in the ass."
Killian nodded.
"However you say, Mr. Richards. You married Sheila Richards, née Gordon, at the age of 16. Old-style lifetime contract. A rebel all the way, huh? No union affiliation due to your refusal to sign the union oath of fealty and the wage control articles? I believe that you refer to Area Governor Johnsbury as a corn-holing son of a bitch."
"Yes,"
Richards said. "Your work record has been spotty, and you've been fired. Let's see, a total of 6 times for such things as insubordination, insulting superiors, and abusive criticism of authority."
Richard shrugged.
"In short, you are regarded as anti-authoritarian and antisocial. You're a deviant who's been intelligent enough to stay out of prison and serious trouble with the government, and you're not hooked on anything. A staff psychologist reports you saw lesbians, excrement, and a pollutive gas vehicle in various inkblots. He also reports a high, unexplained degree of hilarity."
"He reminded me of a kid I used to know. He liked to hide under the bleachers at school and whack off. At the kid, I mean. I don't know what your doctor likes to do."
"I see."
Killian smiled briefly, white teeth glittering in all that darkness, and went back to his folder.
"You held racial responses outlawed by the Racial Act of 2004. You made several rather violent responses during the word association test."
"I'm here on violent business," Richard said.
"To be sure. And yet we... And here I speak in a larger sense than the game's authority. I speak in the national sense. View these responses with extreme disquiet."
"Afraid someone might tape a stick of Irish to your ignition system some night?"
Richards asked, grinning.
Killian wet his thumb reflectively and turned to the next sheet.
"Fortunately for us, you've given a hostage to fortune, Mr. Richards. You have a daughter named Catherine, 18 months. Was that a mistake?"
He smiled frostily. Planned, Richards said without rancor. I was working for GA then. Somehow, some of my sperm lived through it. A jest of God, maybe? With the world the way it is, I sometimes think we must have been off our trolley. At any rate, you're here, Killian said, continuing to smile his cold smile. And next Tuesday, you will appear on The Running Man. You've seen the program? Yes. Then you know it's the biggest thing going on Free V. It's filled with chances for viewer participation, both vicarious and actual. I'm executive producer of the program. That's really wonderful, Richard said. The program is one of the surest ways the network has of getting rid of embryo troublemakers, such as yourself, Mr. Richards. We've been on for 6 years. To date, we have no survivals. To be brutally honest, we expect to have none. Then you're running a crooked table, Richard said flatly. Killian seemed more amused than horrified. But we're not. You keep forgetting you're an anachronism, Mr. Richards. People won't be in the bars and hotels or gathering in the cold in front of appliance stores rooting for you to get away. Goodness, no! They want to see you wiped out. And they'll help if they can. The more messy, the better. And there is McCone to contend with. Evan McCone and the Hunters. They sound like a neo group, Richard said. McCone never loses, Killian said. Richards grunted. You will appear live Tuesday night. Subsequent programs will be a patch-up of tapes, films, and live tricasts when possible. We've been known to interrupt scheduled broadcasting when a particularly resourceful contestant is on the verge of reaching his personal Waterloo, shall we say. The rules are simplicity themselves. You or your surviving family will win $100 for each hour you remain free. We stake you to $4,800 running money, on the assumption that you will be able to fox the Hunters for 48 hours. The unspent balance refundable, of course, if you fall before the 48 hours are up. You're given a 12-hour head start. If you last 30 days, you win the grand prize. $1 billion. Richards threw back his head and laughed. My sentiments exactly, Killian said, with a dry smile. Do you have any questions? Just one, Richard said, leaning forward. The traces of humor had vanished from his face completely. How would you like to be the one out there, on the run? Killian laughed. He held his belly, and huge mahogany laughter rolled richly in the room. Mr. Richards, you must excuse me. And he went off into another gale. At last, dabbing his eyes with a large white handkerchief, Killian seemed to get himself under control. You see, not only are you possessed of a sense of humor, Mr. Richards, I... He choked new laughter down. Please excuse me. You've struck my funny bone. I see I have. Other questions? No? Very good. There will be a staff meeting before the program. If any questions should develop in that fascinating mind of yours, please hold them until then. Killian pressed a button on his desk. Spare me the cheap snatch, Richard said. I'm married. Killian's eyebrows went up. Are you quite sure? Fidelity is admirable, Mr. Richards, but it's a long time from Friday to Tuesday. And considering the fact that you may never see your wife again, I'm married. Very well. He nodded to the girl in the doorway, and she disappeared. Anything we can do for you, Mr. Richards. You'll have a private suite on the 9th floor, and meal requests will be filled within reason. A good bottle of bourbon, and a telephone so I can talk to my... Ah, no, I'm sorry, Mr. Richards. The bourbon we can do, but once you sign this release form... He pushed it over to Richards along with the pen. You're incommunicado until Tuesday. Would you care to reconsider the girl? No, Richard said, and scrawled his name on the dotted line. But you better make that 2 bottles of bourbon. Certainly. Killian stood and offered his hand again. Richards disregarded it again and walked out. Killian looked after him with blank eyes. He was not smiling.
minus 86, and counting. The receptionist popped promptly out of her foxhole as Richards walked through and handed him an envelope. On the front, Mr. Richards.
I suspect one of the things that you will not mention during our interview is the fact that you need money badly, right now. Is it not true? Despite rumors to the contrary, Games Authority does not give advances. You must not look upon yourself as a contestant with all the glitter that word entails. You are not a free V-star, but only a working Joe who is being paid extremely well for undertaking a dangerous job. However, Games Authority has no rule which forbids me from extending you a personal loan. Inside, you will find 10% of your advance salary. Not in new dollars, I should caution you, but in game certificates redeemable $4. Should you decide to send these certificates to your wife, as I suspect you will, she will find they have one advantage over new dollars. A reputable doctor will accept them as legal tender, while a quack will not. Sincerely, Dan Killian.
Richards opened the envelope and pulled out a thick book of coupons with a game symbol on the vellum cover. Inside were 48 coupons with a face value of 10 new dollars each. Richards felt an absurd wave of gratitude toward Killian sweep him and crushed it. He had no doubt that Killian would attach $480 of its advance money, and besides that, $480 was a pretty goddamn cheap price to pay for insurance on the big show, the continued happiness of the client, and Killian's own big money job.
Shit, he said.
The receptionist poked attentively out of her foxhole. Did you say something, Mr. Richards?
No. Which way to the elevators?
Minus 85, and counting. The suite was sumptuous. Wall-to-wall carpeting almost deep enough to breaststroke in covered the floors of all three rooms, living room, bedroom, and bath. The freebie was turned off. Blessed silence prevailed. There were flowers in the vases, and on the wall, next to the door, was a button discreetly marked service.
The service would be fast, too, Richards thought cynically.
There were two cops stationed outside his ninth-floor suite, just to make sure he didn't go wandering. He pushed the service button, and the door opened.
Yes, Mr. Richards, one of the cops said.
Richards fancied he could see how sour that mister tasted in his mouth.
The bourbon you asked for will be... It's not that,
Richards said. He showed the cop the book of coupons Killian had left for him.
I want you to take this somewhere. Just write the name and the address, Mr. Richards, and I'll see that it's delivered.
Richards found the cobbler's receipt and wrote his address and Sheila's name on the back of it. He gave the tattered paper and the coupon book to the cop. He was turning away when a new thought struck Richards.
Hey, just a second.
The cop turned back, and Richards plucked the coupon book out of his hand. He opened it to the first coupon and tore 1/10 of it along the perforated line. Equivalent value? One new dollar.
Do you know a cop named Charlie Grady?
Charlie?
The cop looked at him warily.
Yeah, I know Charlie. He's got fifth floor duty. Give him this.
Richards handed him the coupon section. Tell him the extra 50 cents is his usurer's fee. The cop turned away again, and Richards called him back once more.
You'll bring me written receipts from my wife and from Grady, won't you?
Disgust showed openly on the cop's face.
Ain't you the trustin' soul?
Sure, Richards said, smiling thinly.
You guys taught me that. South of the canal, you taught me all about it.
It's going to be fun, the cop said, watching them go after you. I'm going to be glued to my freebie with a beer in each hand.
Just bring me the receipts, Richards said, and closed the door gently in the cop's face.
The bourbon came 20 minutes later, and Richards told the surprised delivery man that he would like a couple of thick novels sent up.
Novels?
Books. You know, read. Words, movable press.
Richards pantomimed, flipping pages.
Yes, sir, he said doubtfully. Do you have a dinner order?
Oh, Christ, this shit was getting thick. He was drowning in it. Richards saw a sudden fantasy cartoon. Man falls into outhouse hole and drowns in pink shit that smells like Chanel No. 5. The kicker? It still tastes like shit.
Steak, peas, mashed potatoes. God, what was Sheila sitting down to? A protein pill and a cup of fake coffee? Milk, apple cobbler with cream. Got it?
Yes, sir. Would you like?
No, Richard said, suddenly distraught. No. Get out. He had no appetite. Absolutely none. -84, and counting. With sour amusement, Richards thought that the games bellboy had taken him literally about the novels. He must have picked them out with a ruler as his only guide. Anything over an inch and a half is okay. He brought Richards 3 books he'd never heard of. 2 golden oldies titled God as an Englishman and Not as a Stranger, and a huge tome written 3 years ago called The Pleasure of Serving. Richards peeked into that one first and wrinkled his nose. Poor boy makes good in General Atomics, rises from engine wiper to gear tradesman, takes night courses. On what? Richards wondered. Monopoly money? Falls in love with beautiful girl. Apparently syphilis hadn't rotted her nose off yet. At a block orgy. Promoted to junior technico following dazzling aptitude scores. 3-year marriage contract follows and... Richards threw the book across the room. God as an Englishman was a little better. He poured himself a bourbon on the rocks and settled into the story. By the time the discreet knock came, he was 300 pages in and pretty well in the bag to boot. One of the bourbon bottles was empty. He went to the door, holding the other in his hand. The cop was there. Your receipts, Mr. Richards, he said, and pulled the door closed. Sheila had not written anything, but it sent one of Kathy's baby pictures. He looked at it and felt the easy tears of drunkenness prick his eyes. He put it in his pocket and looked at the other receipt. Charlie Grady had written briefly on the back of a traffic ticket form. Thanks, maggot. Get stuffed. Charlie Grady. Richard snickered and let the paper flitter to the carpet. Thanks, Charlie, he said to the empty room. I needed that. He looked at the picture of Kathy again. A tiny, red-faced infant of 4 days at the time of the photo, screaming her head off, swimming in a white cradle dress that Sheila had made herself. He felt the tears lurking and made himself think of good old Charlie's thank-you note. He wondered if he could kill the entire second bottle before he passed out and decided to find out. He almost made it. -83. And counting. Richard spent Saturday living through a huge hangover. He was almost over it by Saturday evening and ordered 2 more bottles of bourbon with supper. He got through both of them and woke up in the pale early light of Sunday morning, seeing large caterpillars with flat, murderous eyes crawling slowly down the far bedroom wall. He decided then it would be against his best interests to wreck his reactions completely before Tuesday and laid off the booze. This hangover was slower dissipating. He threw up a good deal, and when there was nothing left to throw up, he had dry heaves. These tapered off around 6 o'clock Sunday evening, and he ordered soup for dinner. No bourbon. He asked for 12 neo-rock discers to play on the sweet sound system, and tired of them quickly. He went to bed early, and slept poorly. He spent most of Monday on the tiny glassed-in terrace that opened off the bedroom. He was very high above the waterfront now, and the day was a series of sun and showers that was fairly pleasant. He read 2 novels, went to bed early again, and slept a little better. There was an unpleasant dream. Sheila was dead, and he was at her funeral. Somebody had propped her up in her coffin and stuffed a grotesque corsage of new dollars in her mouth. He tried to run to her and remove the obscenity. Hands grabbed him from behind. He was being held by 12 cops. One of them was Charlie Grady. He was grinning and saying, "This is what happens to losers, maggot." They were putting their pistols to his head when he woke up. Tuesday, he said to no one at all, and rolled out of bed. The fashionable GA sunburst clock on the far wall said it was 7:09. The live tricast of The Running Man would be going out all over North America in less than 11 hours.
He felt a hot drop of fear in his stomach. In 23 hours, he would be fair game. He had a long, hot shower, dressed in his coverall, ordered ham and eggs for breakfast. He also got the bellboy on duty to send up a carton of blams. He spent the rest of the morning and early afternoon reading quietly. It was 2 o'clock on the nose when a single formal rap came at the door. 3 police and Arthur M. Burns, looking potty and more than a bit ridiculous in a game singlet, walked in. All of the cops were carrying move-alongs.
"It's time for your final briefing, Mr. Richards," Burns said. "Would you?"
"Sure," Richards said. He marked his place in the book he had been reading and put it down on the coffee table. He was suddenly terrified, close to panic, and he was very glad there was no perceptible shake in his fingers. -82, and counting. The 10th floor of the games building was a great deal different from the ones below, and Richards knew that he was meant to go no higher. The fiction of upward mobility, which started in the grimy street-level lobby, ended here on the 10th floor. This was the broadcast facility. The hallways were wide, white, and stark. Bright yellow go-karts powered by GA solar cell motors pottered here and there, carrying loads of freebie technicos to studios and control rooms. A cart was waiting for them when the elevator stopped, and the 5 of them, Richards, Burns, and Copps, climbed aboard. Necks craned, and Richards was pointed out several times as they made the trip. One woman, in a yellow game shorts and halter outfit, winked and blew Richards a kiss. He gave her the finger. They seemed to travel miles, through dozens of interconnecting corridors. Richards caught glimpses into at least a dozen studios, one of them containing the infamous treadmill seen on Treadmill to Bucks. A tour group from uptown was trying it out and giggling. At last, they came to a stop before a door which read, "The Running Man, Absolutely No Admittance." Burns waved to the guard in the bulletproof booth beside the door, and then looked at Richards.
"Put your ID in the slot between the guard booth and the door," Burns said.
Richards did it. His card disappeared into the slot, and a small light went on in the guard booth. The guard pushed a button, and the door slid open. Richards got back into the cart, and they were trundled into the room beyond.
"Where's my card?" Richards asked. "You don't need it anymore."
They were in a control room. The console's section was empty except for a bald technico who was sitting in front of a blank monitor screen, reading numbers into a microphone. Across to the left, Dan Killian and 2 men Richards hadn't met were sitting around a table with frosty glasses. One of them was vaguely familiar, too pretty to be a technico.
"Hello, Mr. Richards. Hello, Arthur. Would you care for a soft drink, Mr. Richards?"
Richards found he was thirsty. It was quite warm on 10, in spite of the many air conditioning units he had seen.
"I'll have a Rudy Toot," he said.
Killian rose, went to a cold cabinet, and snapped the lid from a plastic squeeze bottle. Richards sat down and took the bottle with a nod.
"Mr. Richards, this gentleman on my right is Fred Victor, the director of the Running Man. This other fellow, as I'm sure you know, is Bobby Thompson."
Thompson, of course. Host and MC of the Running Man. He wore a natty green tunic, slightly iridescent, and sported a mane of hair that was silvery attractive enough to be suspect.
"Do you diet?" Richards asked.
Thompson's impeccable eyebrows went up.
"I beg pardon?"
"Never mind," Richards said.
"You'll have to make allowances for Mr. Richards,"
Killian said, smiling.
"He seems afflicted with an extreme case of the roods."
"Quite understandable," Thompson said, and lit a cigarette. Richards felt a wave of unreality surge over him, under the circumstances.
"Come over here, Mr. Richards, if you please,"
Victor said, taking charge. He led Richards to the bank of screens on the other side of the room. The technico had finished with his numbers and had left the room. Victor punched 2 buttons, and left-right views of the Running Man set sprang into view.
We don't do a run-through here," Victor said. "We think it detracts from spontaneity. Bobby just wings it, and he does a pretty damn good job. We go on at 6 o'clock, Harding time. Bobby is center stage on that raised blue dais. He does the lead-in, giving a rundown on you. The monitor will flash a couple of still pictures. You'll be in the wings at stage right, flanked by two games guards. They'll come on with you, armed with riot guns. Move-alongs would be more practical if you decide to give trouble, but the riot gun's a good theater.
Sure, Richard said.
There would be a lot of booing from the audience. We pack it that way because it's good theater. Just like the kill ball matches.
Are they going to shoot me with fake bullets? Richards asked. You could put a few blood bags on me to spatter on cue. That would be good theater, too.
Pay attention, please, Victor said. You and the guards go on when your name is called. Bobby will, interview you. Feel free to express yourself as colorfully as you please. It's all good theater. Then, around 6:10, just before the first network promo, you'll be given your stake money and exit sans guards at stage left. Do you understand?
Yes. What about Laughlin?
Victor frowned and lit a cigarette.
He comes on after you at 6:15. We run two contests simultaneously because often one of the contestants is inadept at staying ahead of the hunters.
With a kid as a backup?
Mr. Jansky? Yes. But none of this concerns you, Mr. Richards. When you exit stage left, you'll be given a tape machine which is about the size of a box of popcorn. It weighs 6 pounds. With it, you'll be given 60 tape clips, which are about 4 inches long. The equipment will fit inside a coat pocket without a bulge. It's a triumph of modern technology.
Swell. Victor pressed his lips together.
As Dan has already told you, Richards, you're a contestant only for the masses. Actually, you are a working man, and you should view your role in that light. The tape cartridges can be dropped into any mail slot, and they will be delivered express to us, so we can edit them for airing that night. Failure to deposit 2 clips per day will result in legal default of payment.
But I'll still be hunted down.
Right. So mail those tapes. They won't give away your location. The hunters operate independently of the broadcasting section.
Richards had his doubts about that, but said nothing.
After we give you the equipment, you'll be escorted to the street elevator. This gives directly on Rampart Street. Once you're there, you're on your own.
He paused.
Questions?
No.
Then Mr. Killian has one more money detail to straighten out with you.
They walked back to where Dan Killian was in conversation with Arthur M. Burns. Richards asked for another Rudy Toot and got it.
Mr. Richards, Killian said, twinkling his teeth at him.
As you know, you leave the studio unarmed. But this is not to say you cannot arm yourself by fair means or foul. Goodness, no! You or your estate will be paid an additional $100 for any hunter or representative of the law you should happen to dispatch.
I know. Don't tell me, Richard said.
It's good theater.
Killian smiled delightedly.
How very astute of you.
Yes. However, try not to bag any innocent bystanders. That's not kosher.
Richard said nothing.
The other aspect of the program. The stoolies and independent cameraman I know. They're not stoolies. They're good North American citizens.
It was difficult to tell whether Killian's tone of hurt was real or ironic.
Anyway, there's an 800 number for anyone who spots you. A verified sighting pays 100 new dollars. A sighting which results in a kill pays 1,000. We pay independent cameramen $10 a foot and up.
Retire to scenic Jamaica on blood money,
Richards cried, spreading his arms wide.
Get your picture on 100 3D weeklies. Be the idol of millions. Just holograph for details. That's enough,
Killian said quietly. Bobby Thompson was buffing his fingernails. Victor had wandered out and could be faintly heard yelling at someone about camera angles. Killian pressed a button.
Miss Jones, ready for you, sweets.
He stood up and offered his hand again.
Makeup next, Mr. Richards. Then the lighting runs. You'll be quartered off stage, and we won't meet again before you go on, so...
It's been grand, Richards said. He declined the hand. Miss Jones led him out. It was 2:30. Minus 81, and counting. Richard stood in the wings with a cop on each side, listening to the studio audience as they frantically applauded Bobby Thompson. He was nervous. He jeered at himself for it, but the nervousness was a fact.
Jeering would not make it go away.
It was 6:01.
Tonight's first contestant is a shrewd, resourceful man from south of the canal in our own home city, Thompson was saying.
The monitor faded to a stark portrait of Richards in his baggy gray work shirt, taken by a hidden camera days before. The background looked like the fifth-floor waiting room. It had been retouched, Richards thought, to make his eyes deeper, his forehead a little lower, his cheeks more shadowed. His mouth had been given a jeering, curled expression by some technico's airbrush. All in all, the Richards on the monitor was terrifying. The angel of urban death, brutal, not very bright, but possessed of a certain primitive animal cunning. The uptown apartment dweller's boogeyman.
This man is Benjamin Richards, age 28. Know the face well. In a half hour, this man will be on the prowl. A verified sighting brings you $100 new. A sighting which results in a kill results in $1,000 new for you.
Richard's mind was wandering. It came back to the point with a mighty snap.
And this is the woman that Benjamin Richards' award will go to, if and when he is brought down.
The picture dissolved to a still of Sheila, but the airbrush had been at work again, this time wielded with a heavier hand. The results were brutal. The sweet, not-so-good-looking face had been transformed into that of a vapid slattern. Full, pouting lips, eyes that seemed to glitter with avarice, a suggestion of a double chin fading down to what appeared to be bare breasts.
You bastard!
Richards grated. He lunged forward, but powerful arms held him back.
Simmer down, buddy. It's only a picture.
A moment later, he was half-led, half-dragged on stage. The audience reaction was immediate. The studio was filled with screamed cries of, Boo!
Cycle bum! Get out, you creep! Kill him! Kill the bastard! You eat it! Get out! Get out!
Bobby Thompson held his arms up and shouted good-naturedly for quiet.
Let's hear what he's got to say.
The audience quieted, but reluctantly. Richard stood bull-like under the hot lights with his head lowered. He knew he was projecting exactly the aura of hate and defiance that they wanted him to project, but he could not help it. He stared at Thompson with hard, red-rimmed eyes.
Somebody's going to eat their own balls for that picture of my wife, he said. Speak up! Speak up, Mr. Richards!
Thompson cried with just the right note of contempt.
Nobody will hurt you. At least, not yet.
More screams and hysterical vituperation from the audience. Richards suddenly wheeled to face them, and they quieted as if slapped. Women stared at him with frightened, half-sexual expressions. Men grinned up at him with blood hate in their eyes.
You bastards! He cried. If you want to see somebody die so bad, why don't you kill each other?
His final words were drowned in more screams. People from the audience, perhaps paid to do so, were trying to get on stage. The police were holding them back. Richards faced them, knowing how he must look.
Thank you, Mr. Richards, for those words of wisdom.
The contempt was palpable now, and the crowd, nearly silent again, was eating it up.
Would you like to tell our audience in the studio and at home how long you think you can hold out?
I want to tell everybody in the studio and at home that that wasn't my wife. That was a cheap fake. The crowd drowned him out. Their screams of hate had reached a near fever pitch. Thompson waited nearly a minute for them to quiet a little and then repeated,
How long do you expect to hold out, Mr. Richards?
I expect to go the whole 30, Richards said coolly. I don't think you've got anybody who can take me.
More screaming, shaken fists. Someone threw a tomato.
Bobby Thompson faced the audience again and cried,
With those last cheap words of bravado, Mr. Richards will be led from our stage. Tomorrow, at noon, the hunt begins. Remember his face.
It may be next to you on a pneumo bus, in a jet plane, at a 3D rack, in your local killball arena. Tonight, he's in Harding. Tomorrow, in New York.
Boise, Albuquerque, Columbus, skulking outside your home? Will you report him? Yes!
They screamed.
Richards suddenly gave them the finger. Both fingers. This time, the rush for the stage was by no stretch of the imagination simulated. Richards was rushed out the stage left exit before they could rip him apart on camera, thus depriving the network of all the juicy upcoming coverage.